of the destruction. And when we try and understand, well, why young people? Why is it such a generational gap when it comes to the polling on Gaza, on ceasefire? Why are young people so much more anti-war than their elder peers? Part of the reason is that young people are on TikTok or Instagram and seeing a much less sanitized version of this war, of Israel's bombardment. They are seeing babies being pulled from the rubble, limbs missing. They are seeing hospitals being carried, you know, hospitals carrying out procedures without anesthetic. They are seeing just absolute brutality, the kind of stuff that UN humanitarian chiefs are saying we haven't seen in this world for 50 years. And that's the problem, right? If we're sanitizing the coverage, Americans aren't being told, really, aren't being informed, are, again, missing context on what is happening on the ground. And, of course, Israel, by keeping Western journalists out, makes it even easier for those images to be blocked. And therefore, you have Palestinian, brave Palestinian journalists on the ground trying to film, trying to document their own genocide, streaming it to our phones. And we've seen over 100 of them killed over the last 5 months. That is not an accident. That is not a coincidence. Israel wants to stamp out independent voices, stamp out any kind of coverage of its own genocidal behavior. And therefore, again, you're able to have a debate in this country where the political debate is completely disconnected to the public debate, and the public debate is completely misinformed. I'm amazed, Nermeen, when you look at the polling, that there's a majority in favor of a ceasefire, that half of all Democrats say this is a genocide. The Americans are saying that to pollsters, despite not even getting the full picture. Can you imagine what those numbers would look like if they actually saw what was happening on the ground?
Well, I want to go to what is unfolding right now in Gaza. You said in a recent interview that in the past, Israel was, quote, mowing the lawn. But now the Netanyahu government's intention is to erase the population of Gaza. So let's go to what Prime Minister Netanyahu said about the invasion of Rafah, saying it would go ahead and would last weeks, not months. He was speaking to Politico on Sunday.
We're not going to leave them. You know, I have a red line. You know what the red line is? That October 7th doesn't happen again. Never happens again. And to do that, we have to complete the destruction of the Hamas terrorist army. We're very close to victory. It's close at hand. We've destroyed three quarters of Hamas fighting terrorist battalions. And we're close to finishing the last part in Rafah, and we're not going to give it up. Once we begin the intense action in of eradicating the Hamas terrorist battalions in Rafah, it's a matter of weeks and not months.
So, Mehdi, your response to what Netanyahu said and what the Israelis have proposed as a safe place for Gazans to go, namely humanitarian islands.
So, number one, when you hear Netanyahu speaking, I mean, doesn't it remind you of George Bush in kind of 2002, 2003? It's very, you know, invoking 9/11 to justify every atrocity, claiming that you're trying to protect the country when you yourself, your idiocy and your incompetency is what led to the attacks. George Bush was unable to prevent 9/11 and then used 9/11 to justify every atrocity, even though his incompetence helped allow 9/11 to happen. And I feel the same way. Netanyahu allowed the worst terror attack, the worst massacre in Israel to happen on his watch. Many of his own generals, many of his own people blame him for this. And so it's rich to hear him saying, my aim is to stop this from happening again. Well, you couldn't stop it happening the first time, and now you're killing innocent Palestinians under the pretense that this is national security. Number two, again, George Bush-like, claiming that the war is nearly done, mission is nearly accomplished. That's nonsense. No serious observer believes that Hamas is finished or that Israel has won some total victory. A member of Netanyahu's own war cabinet said recently, anyone who says you can absolutely defeat Hamas is telling tall tales, is lying. That was a colleague of Netanyahu's in government who said that. And number three, the red line on Rafah that Biden supposedly set down and that Netanyahu is now mocking, saying my own red line is to do the opposite. What on earth is Joe Biden doing in allowing Benjamin Netanyahu to humiliate him in this way with this invasion of Rafah, even after he said he opposes it? I mean, one thing to leak stuff over a few months.
Let's go to Biden. Speaking on MSNBC, he's being interviewed by your former colleague, Jonathan Capehart, as he was being questioned about Benjamin Netanyahu and saying he's hurting Israel more than helping Israel.
He has a right to defend Israel, a right to continue to pursue Hamas, but he must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. He's hurting, in my view, he's hurting Israel more than helping Israel by making the rest of the world, it's contrary to what Israel stands for. And I think it's a big mistake. So I want to see a ceasefire.
And he talked about a, well, kind of a red line. If you can address what Biden is saying and what he proposed in the State of the Union, this pier, to get more aid in, and also the dropping, the airdropping of food, which recently killed five Palestinians because it crushed them to death, and the humanitarian groups, the United Nations, saying these airdrops, the pier, come nowhere near being able to provide the aid that's needed. At the same time, and the reason they're doing all of this is because Israel is using U.S. bombs and artillery to attack the Palestinians and these aid trucks.
Yeah, it's just so bizarre. The idea that you could drop bombs on the one hand and then drop aid on the other, and you're paying for both, and then your aid ends up killing people too. It's like some kind of Dark Onion headline. It's just beyond parody. It's beyond belief. And as for the pier, as you say, it does not come anywhere near to adequately addressing the needs of the Palestinian people in terms of the sheer scale of the suffering. 500,000 people, on the brink of famine, over 1 million people displaced. 4 out of 5 of the hungriest people in the world, according to the World Food Program, are in Gaza right now. The idea that this pier would, A, address the scale of the suffering, and B, in time. I mean, it's going to take time to do this. What happens to the Palestinians who literally starve to death, including children, while this pier is being built? Finally, I would say there's reporting in the Israeli press, Amy, that I've seen that suggests that the pier idea comes from Netanyahu, that the Israeli government are totally fine with this pier because it allows them still to control land and air access into Gaza, which is what they've always controlled and which in this war they've monopolized. The idea that the United States of America, the world's only superpower, cannot tell its ally, you know what, we're going to put aid into Gaza because we want to and you're not going to stop us, especially since we're the ones arming you, is bizarre. It's something I think Biden will never be able to get past or live down. It's a stain on his record, on America's conscience. The idea that we're arming a country that's engaged in a plausible genocide, to quote the ICJ, is bad enough. That we can't even get our own aid in while they're bombing with our bombs is just madness. And by the way, it's also illegal. Under U.S. law, you cannot provide weaponry to a country which is blocking U.S. aid. And by the way, it's not me saying they're blocking U.S. aid. U.S. government officials have said, yes, the Israeli government blocked us from sending flour in, for example.
So, Mehdi, let's go to the regional response to this assault on Gaza that's been unfolding with the kind of violence and tens of thousands of deaths of Palestinians, as we've reported. Now, how has the Arab and Muslim world responded to what's going on? Egypt, of course, has repeatedly said that it does not want displaced Palestinians crossing its border. The most powerful Muslim countries, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the Emirates. If you talk about how they've responded, and then the so-called axis of resistance, Houthis, Hezbollah, etc., how they've been trying to disrupt this war, or at least make the backers of Israel pay a price for it.
So I hear people saying, oh, we're disappointed in the response from the Arab countries. The problem with the word disappointment is it implies that you had any expectations to begin with. I certainly didn't. Arab countries have never had the Palestinians' backs. The Arab, quote-unquote, Arab street has always been very pro-Palestinian, but the autocratic, the despotic, the dictatorial rulers of much of the Arab world have never really had the interests of the Palestinian people at their heart, going back right to 1948 when, you know, Arab countries attacked Israel to push it into the sea. But actually, as we know from historians like Avi Schleim, we're not doing that at all, and had some of them, like Jordan, had done deals with Israel behind the scenes. So look, Arab countries have never really prioritized the Palestinian people or their needs or their freedom. And so when you see, some of these statements that come out of the Arab world at times like this, you know, you have to take them with a shovel of salt, not just a grain. Also, I would point out the hypocrisy here on all sides in the region. You have countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which were involved in a brutal assault on Yemen for many years, carried out very similar acts to Israel in Gaza in terms of blockades, starvation, malnourishment of the Yemeni children, in terms of bombing of refugee camps and hospitals and kids and school buses. That all happened in Yemen. Arab countries did that. Let's just be clear about that. Things that they criticize Israel for doing now. And of course, Iran, which sets itself up as a champion of the Palestinian people, when Bashar al-Assad was killing many of his own people, including Palestinian refugees, in places like the Al-Yarmouk refugee camp, Iran and Russia, by the way, were both perfectly happy to help arm and support Assad as he did that. So, you know, spare me some of the, you know, grandiose statements from Middle East countries, from Arab nations to Iran on all of it. Like, there's a lot of hypocrisy to go around. Very few countries in the world, especially in that region, actually have Palestinian interests at heart. If they did, we would have a very different geopolitical scene. There is reporting, Nermeen, that a lot of these governments, like Saudi Arabia, privately are telling Israel, finish the job. Get rid of them. We don't like Hamas either. Get rid of them. And that Saudis actually want to do a deal with Israel once this war is over, just as they were on course to do, apparently, according to the Biden administration. We know that other Arab countries already signed the quote-unquote Abraham Accords with Israel on Trump's watch.
I wanted to ask you about the number of dead Palestinian journalists and also the new UN investigation that's just accused Israel of breaking international law over the killing of the Reuters video journalist Assam Abdallah in southern Lebanon on October 13th. An Israeli tank opened fire on him and a group of other journalists. He just set up a live stream on the border in southern Lebanon so that all his colleagues at Reuters and others saw him blown up. The report stating, quote, the firing at civilians in this instance, clearly identifiable journalists, constitutes a violation of international law. And it's not just some in southern Lebanon. Well over 100 Palestinian journalists in Gaza have died. We've never seen anything like the concentration of numbers of journalists killed in any other conflict or conflicts combined recently. Can you talk about the lack of outrage of other major news organizations and what Israel is doing here? Do you think they're being directly targeted, one after another, wearing those well-known press flak jackets? It looks like we just lost audio to Mehdi Hassan.
Amy, I can hear you, Amy, very faintly.
Okay.
And
so,
I'm going to answer your question if you can still hear me.
We can hear you perfectly.
So you're very faint to me. So while I speak, if someone wants to fix the volume in my ear, let me answer your question about journalists. It is an absolute tragedy and a scandal what has happened to journalists in Gaza, that we have seen so many deaths in Gaza. And the real scandal, Amy, is that Western media, a lot of my colleagues here in the US media, have not sounded the alarm, have not called out Israel for what it's done. It's outrageous that so many of our fellow colleagues can be killed in Gaza while reporting, while at home, losing family members. And yet there's not a huge global outcry. When Wael al-Dahdou, who we just saw on the screen from Al Jazeera, loses his immediate family members and carries on reporting for Al Jazeera Arabic, why is he not on every front page in the world? Why is he not a hero? Why is he not sitting down with Oprah Winfrey? I feel like, you know, when Evan Gershovich from the Wall Street Journal is wrongly imprisoned in Russia, we all campaign for Evan to be released. When Ukrainian journalists are killed, we all speak out and are angry about it. But when Palestinian journalists are killed on a level we've never seen before, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, where is the outcry here in the West over the killing of journalists? We claim to care about a free press. We claim to oppose countries that crack down on a free press, on journalism. We say journalism is not a crime. But then I don't hear the outrage from my colleagues here at this barbarism in Gaza, where journalists are being killed in record numbers.
Well, Mehdi, let's go to another issue that is, of course, a pressing one this year, namely the U.S. elections. You've said that the problem with the media here is that it's singularly unable to cover Trump properly. Trump, of course, who is now the nominee. If you could explain what you mean by that and what the effects of that are going to be this year.
Whew, yeah, good question, Naomi. Well, I would say three quick things. Number one, as I mentioned at the start, one of the reasons I set up Zeteo is because I believe there is a fascist threat to the United States from the modern Republican Party, and including its standard bearer, its now official candidate, Donald J. Trump. And we need to speak very clearly about what that fascist threat is. We need to be able to say the F word, not dance around it, not pretend Donald Trump is a normal candidate, not normalize his extremism and racism and bigotry and authoritarianism. And what we're seeing right now, Naomi, after 2020, when we saw some improvement in our coverage of Trump, I feel like we've regressed back to 2016 in many ways, in treating Trump as a spectacle, in benefiting from, you know, whatever ratings he gives media organizations, in asking him softball questions. He recently did an interview on CNBC. It was embarrassing to watch. That is a huge problem. So that's number one. Number two, there is this issue right now, for example, where, look, we have this issue of access journalism where a lot of journalists still need to be able to get guests on air from both parties. And there is this both sidesism, which is very frustrating. And the media needs to really think long and hard about how we do journalism. The old conventions, the old norms cannot apply. There are not two sides to every story. There are not two sides to Holocaust denial or climate change or elections. There's not two sides to whether Joe Biden won the last election or not. So we need to be clear-eyed about what's in front of us. And again, have some respect for our viewers and our readers, and tell them what is going on, that one of our two major parties has been fully radicalized and is now in bed with white supremacists and is spreading some of the worst QAnon conspiracy theories out there. Let's be plain about that. And number three, in terms of the dangers, I mean, we have skin in the game. This idea that the media should be impartial. No, we should have a bias towards truth. We should have a bias towards free press, because the media's survival is at stake here. If Donald Trump wins the election, what do you think is going to happen to a free press? He's not hiding it. He's talked openly about wanting to come after NBC and MSNBC for treason. His allies like Kash Patel have talked about going after the media criminally and civilly. One of his allies, Mike Davis, says if Trump makes him AG, he's going to put me in Guantanamo Bay. This is the kind of open authoritarian rhetoric that we're hearing from the Republican side. And the media cannot pretend that this is normal or not a threat to our very freedoms.
I wanted to finally ask you about what we're taking up in our next segment, the bill to ban TikTok. The measure is going to now be taken up by the Senate. But I wanted to ask you about a particular aspect of it. Palestinian rights activists say Israel's war in Gaza has galvanized anti-TikTok sentiment in conservative and centrist lawmakers. In a leaked post-October 7th audio recording, Jonathan Greenblatt, head of the Anti-Defamation League, can be heard saying, quote, "We have a TikTok problem," referencing declining public support for Israel among younger people. The progressive group Roots Action also noted that AIPAC is the top donor to Congressmember Mike Gallagher, who authored the TikTok ban bill. And this is coming as Donald Trump flip-flopped. He flipped his position on the bill within the last week, now opposing the ban after recently meeting with Republican mega-donor billionaire Jeff Yass, whose company holds a 15% stake in ByteDance, interestingly, major donor to right-wing Israeli think tanks. Mehdi, just your take on that aspect of this.
Well, first off, Donald Trump doesn't believe in anything other than himself. So he should really be supporting this bill. It aligns with his anti-China positions, but he's not, because he might be making money out of not supporting this bill. So that's just a reminder that Donald Trump believes nothing but himself. In terms of the TikTok problem, clearly it's a problem. We discussed earlier, if you have a sanitized war on mainstream media, but you have TikTok showing younger Americans exactly what's going on in terms of the barbarism, the brutality, the mass killing, the starvation, the war crimes, then, of course, that's a problem for the Israeli PR machine, clearly, and for the pro-Israel factions in the United States. And it's ironic when we say, oh, well, it's actually not to do with Israel. It's to do with China. It's to do with not knowing what's going on inside of this company. Come on. I have an issue with Chinese ownership of TikTok. Of course I do, like anyone else. I'm no fan of China. But the idea that other social media companies are somehow transparent or doing a better job on moderation, come on. I mean, look at Elon Musk just this week canceled Don Lemon's new show on his platform on Twitter, on X, because he was asked some moderately tough questions by Don Lemon. This is the kind of, this is the power of big tech in America and billionaires who are controlling our public squares. The idea that dealing with TikTok will help us challenge misinformation or extremism online is just a complete lie.
Awesome. We want to thank you so much for being with us. And we're going to continue this discussion about TikTok in our next segment. Mehdi Hasan, journalist, author, editor-in-chief, now CEO of the new media company Zeteo, until January was a host on MSNBC and Peacock. All the best to you, Mehdi.
Thank you, Amy.
Next up, the U.S. House has passed a bill that could ban TikTok. Back in 15 seconds.
From these lies, back to yesterday. Save tonight. I feel the sun creeping up like TikTok. I'm trying to keep you in my head, but if not, we'll just keep running from tomorrow with our lips locked. Yeah, you got me begging, begging, baby, please don't go.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
In a rare show of bipartisanship, House lawmakers overwhelmingly voted Wednesday to force the social media app TikTok's Chinese owner, ByteDance, to either sell the app or face a ban in the United States.
On this vote, the yeas are 352, the nays are 65. One present, two-thirds being in the affirmative. The rules are suspended. The bill is passed.
TikTok has more than 170 million users in the United States alone, the largest TikTok audience in the world. This is Republican. This is Congress member Raja Krishnamoorthy. But first, Republican Mike Gallagher.
TikTok is a threat to our national security because it is owned by ByteDance, which does the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party. This bill therefore forces TikTok to break up with the Chinese Communist Party. It does not apply to American companies.
Unfortunately, when TikTok has appeared before Congress, whether it's before the House Energy and Commerce Committee or otherwise, it has not been candid, my friends. It has not been candid. First, TikTok said its data is not accessible to China-based ByteDance employees. False. China-based employees routinely access this data.
Last voice is the Democratic Congress member Raja Krishnamoorthy.
The bill that could lead to a TikTok ban was also backed by Democrats. This is House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries.
I don't support a ban on TikTok. The legislation did not ban TikTok. It's simply a divestiture of TikTok so that this social media platform can be owned by an American company that would protect the data and the privacy of the American consumer from malignant foreign interests like the Chinese Communist Party.
Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson Wednesday said he'll, quote, push for the Senate to approve the bill, which President Joe Biden has said he would sign. But other Republicans oppose the bill. This is Georgia Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene.
There are dangers that lie ahead in this. This is really about controlling Americans' data. And if we cared about Americans' data, then we would stop the sale of Americans' data universally, not just with China.
Pretty bad, isn't it?
The bill is the greatest threat to TikTok since the Trump administration, when Trump tried to implement a TikTok crackdown that was struck down in the federal courts. But he did flip his position, Trump did, last week after he met with the billionaire investor, GOP mega donor Jeff Yass, who has a 15% stake in TikTok's parent company, has spent a fortune paying for lobbyists to preserve TikTok. Meanwhile, rights groups like the ACLU say such a ban would violate the right to free speech. For more, we're joined by Ramesh Srinivasan, professor of information studies at UCLA, host of the podcast Utopias, author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow, joining us from Oaxaca, Mexico. Ramesh, thanks so much for being back with us. We only have a few minutes. You do not approve of this ban. Can you talk about your concerns with it?
Absolutely not. It's disenfranchising to many young people in the United States. It is alienating to them, and it is singling out TikTok and China without any evidence whatsoever that they are engaging in any nefarious or spying activity, or are any more extreme in their algorithms and their ways in which they polarize American users than any of the big tech companies, you know, which we've discussed before. So it's absurd and it's theatrical for people like Mark Zuckerberg, et cetera, to be paraded in front of Congress multiple times and even publicly shamed while the actual legislation that takes root is one that singles out TikTok primarily because it's a Chinese company and possibly because it's so prominent amongst Americans and young people in general in this country.
And Ramesh, could you talk about how this fits into the way that other countries have responded to TikTok? India was the first one to ban it, and when India did, it had the highest number of TikTok users in the world. And the fact that so many European governments, the EU, Britain, and other countries, Australia as well, Canada, have placed severe restrictions on the use of TikTok on their private mobile devices. Have they done the same thing for Facebook or Twitter, now X?
I mean, in the Indian case, it seemed to play directly to geopolitical tensions with China. China's being set up, as you all report all the time, as some sort of antagonist, a sort of folly for whatever actions a state would wish to take at this point. That does nothing good to deal with the real issues. If we look at most abuses that big tech corporations and specifically social media platforms have laid upon the world, we're primarily talking about companies like Facebook, Google, and so on. So there's really little to no evidence of this. It's incredible that a bipartisan group of lawmakers would want to take a major instrument of free speech, but also of conversation and discussion, especially amongst young people who feel so, again, alienated and out of touch with the political apparatuses of the United States, to just sort of take them off the platform altogether. There's really no evidence to back that up. What we need is expansive, comprehensive digital rights legislation that really applies to every social media company and gives Americans power over their own data.
You know, one of the things that Trump said, I mean, he switched his position after meeting with a billionaire TikTok investor, and so he's now against the ban. But he said, you know, it'll give more power to what he calls the enemy of the people, Facebook. But right. In fact, talk about that and how it then privileges U.S. and other companies, but they still can invade the privacy of people, sell off all of our data. And what exactly a privacy bill would look like that you, Professor Srinivasan, would approve of?
Thank you for asking that question. So it's politically astute for Trump, and it's sort of such a strange and surreal world, as Mehdi Hassan was just discussing with you all, when we see sort of right-wingers take on I wouldn't really say anti-war positions, but more isolationist positions. Trump recognizes that younger people are on this platform, and he recognizes that now with more and more alienated young people that he could potentially gain their support. Facebook in particular, but many big tech platforms have committed repeated abuses around the world, from labor practices to the hiring of exploited content moderators to mass-scale disinformation that has been directly tied to genocides in other parts of the world, to support of authoritarian leaders and so on. So Trump's critique of Facebook is merely based upon it not supporting his voice writ large all the time and the extreme content that he always puts out. But what we really need is to recognize that everything we do in our lives, and this is not just true in the United States or here in Oaxaca, Mexico, but all around the world, almost everything we do is turned into data, into what we call digital footprints. But that data is being harvested by private corporations and states, right? Basically everybody but ourselves. It's basically a taking away of democratic power. So what we need to do is to really have power ourselves and have constituencies have power over controlling what data is being collected about us, how it's being retained, how it's being aggregated, how it's being bought and sold. And what we really need is expansive legislation, again, that deals with the economic outcomes of digital rights. You know, we need to support data unions, paying people so people have even equity in data-grabbing corporations. Note, many of these corporations started on the backs of an internet that all of us paid for, American taxpayers, and use our roads, our infrastructures, without paying taxes. So what we need are economic rights. We need personal rights so we control what is datafied about us. We need to ask big questions about what should not be datafied and what should not be in the hands of these shady corporations, recognizing that our data are bought and sold, and that can be very, very much a violation of a free competition. We've seen a lot of Federal Trade Commission acts. And basically what this is being doing is to wield us. It's influencing our behavior. It's influencing our lives. It's constructing our consumption. It's even constructing our sense of desire. And as we've talked about, it's reinforcing discrimination through discriminatory algorithms and discriminatory practices. So what we need are rights-based legislation that are not just about individual rights or privacy, but really bleed into the question of the economic rights we all have and need to have around the planet in our digital lives.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Ramesh Srinivasan, professor of information studies at UCLA, host of the podcast Utopias, author of Beyond the Valley, speaking to us from Oaxaca, Mexico. A hilarious side note is so many young people were calling into Congress saying, what's Congress? What's a senator? Because TikTok said they should call. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The FCAT After School Podcast is back for its third season.
Starting January 10th, you'll hear interviews and profiles from Simon Fraser University's Faculty of Communication, Art, and Technology alumni with lives lived and stories to tell.
Subscribe to the FCAT After School Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be sending a new episode down your feed every other Wednesday starting January 10th.
Or catch us on 90.1 FM CJSF every Tuesday at 4 p.m. starting January 16th.
Hey folks, Joey Kass.